TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
Good morning. It's 7:41 at the Big Talker 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. It is Tuesday, and that means we talk with the folks with the Charleston County School District, but we're doing it a little bit differently. Angela Henderson doesn't work for Charleston County School District, but she is involved in a project that is helping out some of its students. Let's talk to her right now. Angela Henderson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Charlie. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we get into the project that you're involved with, what do you do?
Well, my husband and I, we have been staff pastors at a local church mm-hmm. here in North Charleston, the North Palm Community Church, for about 30 years. So that's one of the things that we do, and it's one of the most important things. We are also local real estate owners, so mm-hmm. we own a very small company, Paradigm Homes and Investments, and we're also life coaches. We also have another business that's called Mountain Mile, and we are also contracted through another company called Fortune Management. So we do a little bit of everything.
It sounds like you are very, very busy. So what is Project Home that you're involved in?
This is a beautiful mission. Project Home was a dream of Principal Kim Wilson and myself to be able to provide a facility for young men who are needing some mm-hmm. shelter just to finish their education. And we didn't want it to be institutionalized in the sense of just this big building, but we wanted it to be institutionalized in the sense of family.
Right.
And so it provides a family structure for them.
So how did you get involved in this? What was the spark that said, I am going to get involved with this, I'm going to team up with Kim Wilson, and we're going to get something done?
The teachers at Stahl High School are phenomenal. They do more than just teach, but they are just people of great heart and compassion for their students. And so one of the teachers, her name is Allison Gable, saw an article about a home in Missouri. And so she brought it to Mr. Wilson's attention, and he called me and invited me into his office one day, and he just said, I want you to read this, and then we'll talk. So when I read it, I couldn't get through it without tears in my eyes, and I just looked up at him, and I said, okay, when do we get started?
Right.
And so then we began our mission.
So when you get started, that means you got to raise money, right? How long did it take you to raise the money for the house?
Well, you know, we're still in that process. Mm-hmm. It's been over a year ago. February was a year ago that we began, and we just started out with, you know, a big team and just doing some research and some steering and some planning. But it really, honestly, did not take long. Once the word got out through community, people just began to just pour in what they had to offer. I can't say that it was a bunch of big contributors as
right.
much as it was many small contributors, and it's phenomenal what's happened and the interest that has peaked and arisen in our community.
So really sort of a grassroots effort, as they say.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, groundbreaking ceremony was yesterday. You had the mayor of North Charleston, Keith Summey, there. Anita Zucker was there. Charleston County School Board members had Charleston County Council members there. It seems like a lot of people were really behind this project.
We are very blessed to have the support that we have with our community leaders and governmental leaders, as well as just people of influence. It's been phenomenal. And, you know, even the house itself, you know, being named after one of a very dear, precious lady who says is phenomenal. And she did, you know, give the majority of the funds towards the house itself. And it's just the support has just been unbelievable.
So why is it called Mickey's House?
Well, Miss Mary Welch from West Virginia contributed a good bit of the funds, and she just saw this need and wanted to be able to reach out so that we could be able to enter into this endeavor, not having a mortgage over our heads
mm-hmm.
because it's going to take time, you know, to be able to also maintain the home, the program itself, for the young students that are coming in, as well as house parents, because that's one of our key things here is that we want to make sure that there are house parents that give it that family environment. And so we named it after her. Her nickname is Mickey.
All right. So we know the groundbreaking was yesterday. When do you expect the house to be completed?
Eastwood Homes is building our house, and they have partnered with us to have it built by August. Mid-August is when school begins, and we want it open by then so that it's ready for the students who need it.
Right. Do you disclose where it's located?
It is going to be located in the Colony North community in mm-hmm. Charleston.
Okay. Now, how do you pick the students that are going to live there?
We're going to work in partnership with the principal at Stahl High School. Since we began this project, Mr. Kim Wilson has been repositioned to a county seat, which is really beautiful concerning the vision that we have. So we have Mr. Jeremy Carrick, who has followed him at Stahl and very much on board with the project. So we will work closely with him as students come to his attention that are in need of such a home. Then he will come to us, and then from there we will go through the process.
Right. You talk about the vision. Is Mickey's House the vision, or is the vision bigger?
The vision is bigger because, of course, the need is bigger.
Right.
Mickey's House will only house 4 students, and we're keeping it small for family environment, just to have that structure. But our goal is to be able to have one of these homes provided for each high school, within the district. And who knows where it'll go from there. We're not going to limit this.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So what stands out to you the most about a project like this? Is it the mission, the way the funds were raised, everybody that was involved, or is there something else that really stands out to you?
For me, I think it's community. You're amazed at how people will come to the cause of this and rise up. Never expecting it to be as big as it has gotten. But I love the quote by Mother Teresa where it says, "Together we can do great things." Mm-hmm. And I'm witnessing that.
All right. Angela Henderson, thank you so much for being on the program this morning. We hope to talk to you soon and keep us updated about how the construction's going.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Angela Henderson with Project Home.
It's a Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, as we continue with the Charlie James Show right here on 1250 WTMA.
Good morning. It's 7:55. I think it's 7:56 now. 4 minutes until 8 o'clock. Boy, this morning just flying by. 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. That's 556-1250. Don't forget, coming up at 9:06 this morning, give or take, we're going to be talking with the authors of a new book called Shattered, and they recount, the book is called Shattered, basically the failed Hillary Clinton campaign, and they're going to tell us what happened the night that Hillary Clinton found out that she was not going to be the president of the United States. And it's seriously, it's unbelievable. Some of the stuff that they were privy to while they were there. So we'll have that interview coming up for you at 9:06 this morning. You don't want to miss out on that. It's going to be very, very interesting to see. Yeah, of course, we heard a lot of stuff about what happened that night and why it took so long for Hillary to concede this thing. Apparently she wasn't going to until Obama called her and said, "Well, you know, Hillary, I think it's about time we gave up the ghost on this thing." So we'll have the authors on that, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. They'll be on at 9:06 this morning. Shattered, inside Hillary Clinton's doomed campaign, they said. And we'll find out why it was doomed from the get-go. What were some of the mistakes they made? I mean, we've heard so many different things since November as to why she lost the election. And, of course, it was because of Russian hacking. It was because of, the FBI, that probe. It was because of, the vast right-wing conspiracy and all of that. So we'll find out what they have to say about that and what their opinion, what the real reason was that Hillary lost the presidency of the United States. And a lot of people, have been talking about the first 100 days. I thought it was pretty funny that Sean Spicer tweeted out a couple days ago. He said the best thing about Donald Trump's first 100 days in office, they weren't Hillary Clinton's first 100 days in office. Let's go to Oren out in Hollywood. Oren, how are you? Are you there?
Yeah, Charlie?
Yeah. What's up, bud?
Listen, I just want to say real quick, what's the most beautiful thing about Trump's first 100 days?
It wasn't Hillary's first 100 days.
Hillary's first 100 days.
Yeah, definitely.
Good morning.
Yeah, all right, buddy. You have a great day. It's going to be interesting to hear what they have to say about that. That's coming up 9:06 this morning. Also, 9:35, trying to wrangle in Michael Graham from the Washington Examiner. We'll see if he'll be able to call in on the show, because we're going to be talking to him about this budget deal and the state of the GOP in general right now, because there are a lot of Republicans out there that aren't happy with the lack of action from Congress.
The TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
Good morning. It's 8:11, 11 minutes past 8 o'clock on the Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. Glad to have you along with us on this Tuesday morning. So, Morning Joe this morning is trying to make their 8 or 9 listeners or viewers think that President Donald Trump is removed from his faculties, that he's not mentally competent, that he's not not at all a wise man. In fact, they're trying to say that he is mentally unstable. And the reason that Joe Scarborough was talking about this morning was because of an interview, mainly where Donald Trump was talking about the Civil War.
In another interview, President Trump said he thinks the Civil War could have been prevented. Yeah. After hearing this, John McCain said, "Trust me, I did everything I could."
There you go. So now the author, or not the author, the interviewer in this interview where President Trump was talking about the Civil War, she had something pretty telling to say. Now, because this doesn't make headlines. The punchline makes the headlines. That's it. We don't have headlines in the media anymore. We have punchlines. And all the comedians are jumping in on this. So here's what President Trump had to say.
I mean, had Andrew Jackson been a little bit later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He was a very tough person, but he had a big heart, and he was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, "There's no reason for this." People don't realize, you know, the Civil War. You think about it, why? People don't ask that question. But why was there the Civil War? Why could that one not have been worked out?
All right, so that's what he had to say, and that's the big punchline. That's why Joe Scarborough is saying that Donald Trump has taken leave of his senses. The author, or like I said, the interviewer, had something very telling to say. Here's what she said. Everything in context, anything out of context is a lie, because of what all these people were saying about this interview with Donald Trump. Okay, where is he wrong about this? Where is he wrong? And even Chelsea Clinton, you know, he said, well, why couldn't the Civil War been prevented? And Chelsea Clinton pops up, slavery, 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 slavery. That's the way she talks. That is a really good Chelsea Clinton impression, by the way. So his point was, why could not the Civil War have been prevented? Why couldn't more? Now, we know that slavery was at the heart of the Civil War. That, you know, you can say states' rights or whatever you want to, but it was the states' rights to keep slavery. Why couldn't that have been negotiated better? Why couldn't something better have been done to prevent what? Several million people from losing their lives? So the media is jumping on this, and Joe Scarborough, who says he's a Republican, but we all know he's not. He's just like, you know, what we're seeing now, half the members of the GOP. They're really just Democrats in disguise. And the fact that he's, you know, got a little thing going on there with Mika Brzezinski, his co-host. Yeah, they're in a relationship. So, and she's a big Democrat. So he's going to have to acquiesce to her. Guys, you know how that goes, right? You start thinking the wrong way. You know what I mean? So Scarborough wants you to think that the president is now taking leave of his senses. That's the only way that they can do it. That's the only way that they can come along and say, hey, look, they're going to do anything that they can possibly do to undermine and delegitimize the Trump presidency. And if that means trying to make him sound insane or losing his senses or not mentally stable, they are going to do it. Hey, they tried to do it with George W. Bush, didn't they?
WTMA. It's Charlie James on 1250 WTMA.
Good morning. It's 22 minutes past 8 o'clock on the Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. The attacks on President Trump continue. And, you know, it's just like they haven't let up. Since the day that he announced that he was going to run for president of the United States, the media attacks have not let up. Let's go and talk to Chip Limehouse. Good morning, Chip. How are you?
Charlie, good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing good. But I tell you what, Joe Scarborough this morning trying to make his 8 or 9 viewers think that President Trump is insane.
What I don't understand about Joe Scarborough is why he did not apply the same level of scrutiny and parsing the words of President Obama, because President Obama certainly, I'm not saying that Trump made faux pas, but President Obama certainly made his fair share of faux pas.
Sure.
And he just glossed over them. Don't you remember the statement, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor?
Right. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan. But none of the
plan, I mean, the whole Obamacare was one big, long pack of lies. That's all it was one big, long pack of lies. And the media, including Joe Scarborough, just glossed over it. I'm just wondering, was Joe ever a Republican? I'm not saying because I'm a member of the same party as Trump that I always have to say good things about him, but it seems like Joe just wears him out on a daily basis and trashes him. And all he said that I got out of it was Andrew Jackson, had he been around, maybe he could have mitigated and worked out the
right
circumstances that led to the Civil War. And boy, wouldn't that have been a wonderful thing if we could have saved all those lives? I mean, how is that a crime to say that? Then he said he'd be honored to meet with Kim Jong-un.
Right.
And what's wrong with that? The tensions are at an all-time high. What is wrong with making nice with the leader, even though he's a deranged, you know, person?
Right. Yeah.
Nice
yeah.
With him versus because the other alternative is when they test a missile, we have to respond. So I think it would be better to let Trump say nice things about these people.
Well, all he said was he seemed to be a pretty smart cookie. And why wouldn't he? I mean, look, the guy was able to get nuclear weapons. He was able to get centrifuges to spin down plutonium to make it weapons grade. And all of this while sanctions were supposed to be in place, starting with the Clinton administration. So you got to be pretty much on the ball if you can negotiate deals like that. But
I think exactly. And I think the media is bipolar, by the way. I think the media, not only is it fake news, but I think it's bipolar news, because they were criticizing Trump several weeks ago for escalating the situation over with North Korea. During the campaign, they were criticizing Trump for making nice with Russia. Then they
right.
criticized him about a month ago for bringing things to our relations to almost a violent head. And so they're so bipolar. It really makes no sense that how they approach things.
Right. And they always want to talk, you know, hey, we've got to have a diplomatic solution to the escalation of, you know, of tensions between us and Russia. We've got to have a diplomatic solution to, between us and North Korea. So when the president says, yeah, I'll sit down with him, isn't that a diplomatic solution rather than going to war?
Exactly. And that's the way the president should approach things. He should try everything possible diplomatically. And if you're getting ready to meet with a guy, if I'm getting ready to meet with Charlie James, I would go to my restaurant and get his favorite bourbon out and
right.
get it ready for him. And when he comes to meet with me, I'd serve him his favorite bourbon and cater to the guy.
Yeah.
Work things out. And that's what Trump is as a businessman. But, I mean, Scarborough, he came on this morning and he was trashing Trump to the point where you would have thought Trump was mentally off
right.
the way they're portraying it. And if you look at the context of where we are, well, General Mattis is running things in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a cohesive plan to win there. We've got Neil Gorsuch has now swung the Supreme Court 5-4 in favor of the conservatives, which will go on for the next 15, 20 years.
Right.
He's young and he's a runner. He'll be around.
Yeah.
And Trump has rolled back all the stupid, insane regulations that the Obama administration had passed through fiat over the years. And he's trying to get Congress to pass health care and to pass tax cuts. So, you know, like I said, I wasn't early on a Trump supporter, but I think the guy's doing a great job, and I wish they would just stop with this constant harassment and trashing. That's all.
Yeah, you know, and they were so upset that he sent those Tomahawk cruise missiles over to Syria. But how? But if he had done nothing, then the media would have been just as upset with him.
The response to Syria was 100% appropriate. The Syrians should have been tomahawked a long time ago. They've been killing children with gas, and I don't care what side you're on. I don't care what your politics are. You cannot gas civilians
right. In
the context of a war or non-war in your country. Trump did the exact right thing with the tomahawk response, and you know I think he's doing a great job, and I stand behind the president. And I wish the media would stop undermining him. That's all.
I agree. Chip, I appreciate you calling in, buddy. We'll talk to you soon.
Have a great week.
Thank you very much. Chip Limehouse on with us this morning, and he's right. If being a Republican were against the law, I don't think there's enough evidence against Joe Scarborough to convict him. I think he would get off scot-free. So his constant slamming of the Republicans and of the president, where they sat back for 8 years and just gave Obama a pass on everything, the whole healthcare debacle. Remember healthcare.gov? That was a debacle, but they got a pass. And I don't like to give Stephen Colbert a whole lot of props on this show because I think he's an embarrassment. But even he was the one, when Catherine Sebelius was on his program, he tried to say, listen, am I just being an idiot here? How come you guys are having so much trouble with this healthcare.gov website? And that was, I think that was the last time that he was even giving any semblance of being fair and balanced. And of course, you get one little example like that, but other examples like this one.
Now, there was a nice moment when John Dickerson talked about some previous president's thoughts with Trump, other men who have stood in that room and their thoughts about the responsibilities of the presidency. But I'm not quite sure that Donald Trump understood the message.
George W. Bush said the reason the Oval Office is round is there are no corners you can hide in.
Well, there's truth to that. There is truth to that. There are certainly no corners.
Wait. I don't know if that's what he meant.
Okay. Let's be positive. At least he knows his shapes.
Oh, there you go. Trying to make President Trump look like an idiot. That's the game plan that it's been with the Republicans, I don't know, since Lincoln, I would imagine.
1250 WTMA.
Now, here's more of the TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
Good morning. It's 8:40. 20 minutes until 9 o'clock on The Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. Glad to have you along with us Tuesday morning. And I'll tell you what, you know, summer's here, and we're going to be getting outside a little bit more. Even though we didn't have that much of a difficult winter, folks are going to be going outside a lot more. And when you head to the beach, I know a lot of people, you know, you hear about that woman who was allegedly bit by a shark out on Folly, and you start worrying about that. But you got other things to worry about while you're traipsing around outside, and that is snake bites. And apparently, the number of snake bites that have been reported this year have quadrupled those of last year. Not really sure why that is. I don't know if maybe people just started getting out a little bit earlier, or maybe the snakes are a little more rambunctious this year because of the mild winter. But be careful when you're walking around outside, because snake bites are, like I said, quadrupling the numbers from last year. So what do you do? How do you protect yourself against snake bite? Well, number one, I find the best way is just not to go outside. That's, to me, is you got a TV inside. And if you want to see what it's like outside, you can always go to, you know, a webcam or something and see what's going on. But the calls to the Carolina Poison Center about snake bites, like I said, fourfold over what they were seeing last year. Copperheads, cottonmouths, rattlesnakes. We're talking about the eastern diamondback, the pygmy, and the timber rattlesnake. That's a nasty one, that little timber rattler. And the coral snake are all the venomous species that are native to North Carolina and South Carolina. The most rare is the coral snake. And, of course, the copperhead is the most plentiful. I cannot stand a copperhead. Oh, man. I do not. Yep. Sorry. You animal control folks. that's fine with you. But if I see a copperhead, I'm killing a copperhead, if I can do so safely. I'm not a big fan of those snakes at all. Now, the coral snake, basically, in order to be bitten by a coral snake, you have to do one thing. You got to mess with it. And a lot of people, they'll see a coral snake and they'll think it's a king snake, but it's not. It's a coral snake, which is a direct cousin, we'll say, to the king cobra. And it's got the same type of venom. Now, you can always tell a coral snake, just remember this. Ready? Red touch black, friend to Jack. If the red band touches a black band, then it's harmless. Red touch yellow, kill a fella. All right, red touch black, friend to Jack. Red touch yellow, kill a fella. If the red band touches the yellow band, then he is highly poisonous. However, there's even a better way that you can avoid being bitten by a coral snake, and that's not to mess with it whatsoever. Don't try to catch snakes while you're out there. But most of the calls are coming in are about these doggone copperheads, which I just cannot stand. They really do a lot of damage when they bite you. And that's something I've been struck at before and never been bit. Thank goodness. Here's some things that you do not do, no matter what people tell you to do. Do not cut the area and try to suck the venom out. No, that can cause infection. And if you have a cut in your mouth, guess what? Now you're poisoned too. Do not ice the area. They say icing causes additional tissue damage. Do not apply a tourniquet or a tight bandage. They say, the CPC says, it's better for the venom to flow through your body. That doesn't sound like better to me. Anyway, also don't try to catch or kill the snake. You might get bitten again. Always check your boots and your shoes when they're out in the garage or you leave them outside. And you should wear sturdy boots when outside, especially when you're gardening or hiking, and always watch your step. Use a flashlight in the dark. So, just one of those. And again, it's just one of those little phobias I have. Well, I'm not a big phobia guy. I don't get creeped out by a whole lot of things, but a snake and a snake bite is something I never want to experience. Ugh, don't want to do that. So be careful. Apparently, snake bites are up this year, well over last year.
It's Charlie James on 1250 WTMA.
Good morning. It's 8:51. 9 minutes until 9 o'clock on The Big Talker, 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. Don't forget, coming up at 9:06 this morning, we're going to be talking with the authors of a new book called Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We'll be talking with Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes about this new book because it kind of details why she lost the campaign and even goes into what happened that night of the election when the clock was ticking and that realization started to set in that Hillary Clinton was not going to be the president of the United States. So apparently even Bill Clinton called Terry McAuliffe, and McAuliffe was supposed to come down or fly up to Washington and take part in the celebration ceremony, and Bill Clinton called him and said, "Yeah, there's not going to be a celebration this year, Terry. Sorry." All right, 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. That's 556-1250. Well, the big announcement was made yesterday that Ryan Seacrest is going to be the new co-host with Kelly Ripa.
Now, here are Kelly Ripa and Ryan Seacrest.
It is Monday, May 1st, 2017.
Well, does she sound like a young Joy Behar there? She does, doesn't she? Listen.
I've made it through 7 minutes on my first anniversary being with you, so yeah. I feel like this is a full commitment.
It's a full commitment,
yes. I'm excited about it.
I'm excited, too.
It's been funny because Kelly and I, we're friends. We've known each other for a long time.
A long time.
And when we found out this was going to happen, we were told to keep it a secret. And we're not great at
which is
that.
Very hard for us. We are verbal people.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's funny because I sent a text to some of my close friends and coworkers. I said, "I've got great news." Responses were this from people who know me well. "You're engaged." "No."
"Yeah."
"You're having a baby." "It's not that." "You're coming out of the closet." Lisa, how long have you known me? 6 years. I said, well, it's none of that.
Yeah, right.
It's this, and I couldn't be more excited to be here with you
every single day. Me too.
Oh, yeah. We're all excited. We're all excited about that. Can you imagine? Let's see how long this little honeymoon lasts. Because Kelly Ripa is renowned in the television industry of having a gigantic ego. And so is Mr. Ryan Seacrest. So we'll see how long this lasts. But I'm just wondering before how long it's going to be before Ryan Seacrest comes after your job.
First, it was just a radio show.
On Air with Ryan Seacrest.
Then it was television's number one show.
Welcome back to American Idol.
When it ended, he said,
Seacrest, out!
But he lied, because Seacrest is back.
Kelly Ripa and Ryan Seacrest!
Plus the possible return of Idol, the radio show, the weekly countdown, New Year's Rockin' Eve, executive producer of the Kardashians franchise, and there's more, because now he wants your job. He wants to find out what you do and take it away from you. He's also interested in your partner. Male or female doesn't matter because he's Ryan Seacrest and he can do it all. Ryan Seacrest urges you to post your personal information now at SeacrestDeMan.com. If not, he'll find you in his spare time and take you for everything you've got. No joke, he's got that Dick Clark youth serum and you'll never be able to compete. Ryan Seacrest, nothing can stop him. Or that dazzling smile.
Yeah. Coming after your job next. All right. 556-1250 is the number to be on the program this morning. You know, we got a shortened state house session up in Columbia, and they're trying to get as much done as they can in the little bit of time that they have. Lawmakers have yet to agree on some of the big ticket items ahead of the May 11th adjournment. So what have they got? 8 days? To get all of this stuff done, including the state's budget and increasing the state's gas tax to fund the highways. Now, by law, the General Assembly must enact a budget by July the 1st, but they're going to be, they'll be done on May 11th. State law does allow lawmakers to set aside a number of bills, including the budget, for discussion and debate in a special session that is expected to take place starting May 23rd. Now, since this is the first of a 2-year session, bills that don't become law by May 11th can be considered again in January. So let's take a look at what they have to do this year. All right, they got to look at the roads. They got this thing's been about 3 years coming. Senate last week passed a roads bill that increases the gas tax by 12 cents a gallon. Also includes various tax rebates for South Carolina. The House version of this bill increases the state's 16.75 cent per gallon gas tax by 10 cent over 5 years to create a dedicated source of money for repairing South Carolina's crumbling roads. A compromise committee will have to hash out the details, and then they will send it on to the governor to sign. McMaster says he's not going to sign it. We'll find out. Also, some gun bills that are going to be on the table. They're going to look at one bill that would allow anyone that can legally carry or legally own a gun to carry a gun and to do so openly without going through the concealed weapons permit process. That cleared the House earlier this year. That's yet to be scheduled for a Senate hearing, making that unlikely to pass this year. Also, a bill that would allow first responders to carry weapons on public school grounds also passed the House earlier this year, but was not scheduled by the Senate. I don't see why the first responders, we're talking about firemen, EMTs, things like that, the first people that are on the scene at a tragedy, I don't really have a big problem as long as they are trained and I don't know. I don't really have a problem with those guys showing up with weapons on their side, especially since we're hearing now that all over the country, some of these first responders, when they show up, they're being shot at. They're being shot at. So why would they not be able to defend themselves? So also they're going to be talking about medical marijuana, ethics, anti-Semitism. They're trying to just get a definition of that. And of course, the budget. They want to be talking about the budget this year. So they've still got a lot of work to do and 8 days to do it. Now, like we said, they can put some of this off, but they're going to be busy over the next week and a day to try to get all this done before they can go back to their districts and start campaigning. All right, coming up in just a few minutes, again, we're going to be talking with, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes about their new book. It's called Shattered: Inside Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We will have that for you coming up in just a few minutes. That's going to be interesting to see, to talk to these folks about, because they were basically, they were privy to a lot of the conversations and a lot of the things that were going on there with the Clinton campaign while these election results were coming in. And one of the questions I really want to get the answer to this morning was, at what time did the reality set in? What was that moment like?
The TMA Morning Show with Charlie James.
Good morning. It's 6 minutes past 9 o'clock on the Big Talker 1250 WTMA, WTMA.com. On your Tuesday morning, it's time to go to the phones right now and talk with the authors of a new book, Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. On the phones with us right now, we have Amy Parnes. We'll talk with her. Amy, how are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I appreciate you calling in. Also, John, are we ready to take Jonathan? We've got Jonathan Allen with us. Jonathan, how are you this morning?
Doing very well. How are things in South Carolina?
Absolutely fantastic. We appreciate you being on the program. The book is called Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Tell us a little bit about the title. What doomed this campaign for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think, first off, there were some things that she did even before the campaign started that really got off on the wrong foot. The email server she set up at the State Department,
right,
and those speeches she gave to Wall Street banks, I mean, in a time of rising populism. So you start off with that. But then she had a lot of difficulty articulating a message to voters that I think, you know, one that was received as being more about them than about her. I think that was something that plagued her throughout the campaign. And, you know, just there were a lot of things she did that if you were, you know, watching sports, watching hockey or soccer, you'd call them own goals. Just sort of scored on herself.
Right. Amy, do you think she spent too much time focused on Donald Trump?
No, I think she needed to worry about Donald Trump from the beginning. And I think one of her advisors basically circulated a memo early on in the spring of 2016 when she was still in the primary to say, fact, Donald Trump can be president of the United States. It wasn't, for whatever reason, taken very seriously. I think that the Clinton campaign felt like they were well ahead on policy issues. And but the thing that they didn't really have, the thing that Donald Trump had, was a message. And even though it was simple, it was make America great again.
Right.
People knew exactly what he was for. They knew that he wanted to build a wall. They knew what his positions on trade were. They basically had an idea of who this guy is. And Hillary Clinton kind of struggled with that all along.
I mean, her message was, I'm with her.
It was, I'm with her.
I'm with you, but where are we going? That was kind of what a lot of people were feeling about this. But,
right,
you know, here's Hillary Clinton. She's doing very well in the polls throughout the campaign. On the night of the election, what was that like? Were you guys there with them on the night of when the returns were coming in?
We were not. Amy was at the Javits Center in New York where the victory party was supposed to be happening. I was in Washington, D.C. But what we did is spend a lot of time right after the election talking to people who were in the suite with Hillary Clinton,
right,
at the Peninsula Hotel in Manhattan. And we've got, this book has the first real behind-the-scenes TikTok of the moments where she realizes she's going to lose the presidency that she's been after for at least 10 years,
right,
and a flurry of calls back and forth between the White House and the Clinton campaign, including President Obama and Hillary Clinton, spoke twice that night, and then her call to Donald Trump to congratulate him, she never thought she was going to make.
Right. I mean, that had to be a tense moment. What time of the evening? Because I remember watching these returns coming in, and it's 9 o'clock, 9:15, 9:30. They still haven't called Pennsylvania for Hillary Clinton. They still haven't called some of these other big key blue states for Hillary Clinton. Something had to be going on. There had to be a flurry of activity. What was that like? According to your interviews, what was that like in the Clinton campaign when the realization really started to set in that they're going to be in trouble?
Well, they're watching Florida come in, and Florida isn't going well, and Bill Clinton is calling down to Florida to chat with his advisors. Mm-hmm. They're reporting back that it's not, that it's going south. And then, so they basically are told by Robbie Mook, the campaign manager, and others to kind of hold on to hope in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania. When those states come in, obviously, it's not looking good.
Right.
So there is a discussion in the room about what to do next. Hillary Clinton, who was never really dressed to go out for the evening, by then it was late in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Her concession speech had basically, there had been a rough draft written of it. She hadn't really even seen it until that moment. So she, there was a debate about whether, what tone she needed to, you know, she had to call. There's also pressure at the same time coming from the White House to concede. President Obama is calling his key, one of his top advisors is calling and basically saying, you need to concede. So she picks up the phone and calls him and concedes. But at the same time, they're trying to rework the draft that they had written on the concession speech. So she instructs aides to kind of go back and tweak it and rework it to kind of strike the right tone, because she felt like the first draft was a little too harsh and
right.
Would basically be like a campaign speech again. But there was a really big debate in the room about how to handle that. And I think she wanted to be a little more diplomatic, and that's ultimately the tone she took.
Was there a lot of finger pointing, according to the folks that you talked to? What was the emotion that was going on during that time?
Well, you definitely had some people start to throw each other under the bus in terms of at the staff level. You know, you had the people who were sort of data number crunchers, were I guess the central focus of a lot of that. The pollsters were saying that they weren't really good at what they were doing. But the truth is, within 24 hours of this election, Hillary Clinton's narrative was set. There was a meeting in her Brooklyn headquarters. Some people may have been conferenced in on a line. But they basically decided they were going to go after Russia and Jim Comey and point their fingers externally instead of looking at what the campaign could have done differently. And so that's what you've heard over the last several
months.
So a lot of blame casting. At other people, even though, you know, I mean, Jim Comey never would have been able to weigh into the election if there hadn't been an email server in the first place.
Right, right. So, and again, when you're talking to these people, are they still reluctant to go in and do a full autopsy of this campaign to find out exactly why Hillary lost?
I think some of them, obviously, they realize that, well, you know, there's a lot of blame cast right now on Russia and Jim Comey, the FBI director.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people feel like that's the reason why they lost, Hillary Clinton included. But I think some others realize, we talked to one senior advisor who basically said, this is post-election, I would have had a reason for running or I wouldn't have run.
Right.
That's kind of a concession. And, from someone very high up in the campaign who realized that she didn't really have the right message. She was kind of a mismatched candidate for the time.
When you talk about the title of the book, Inside Hillary's Doomed Campaign, did Hillary not listen to her advisors? Were there people that were saying, listen, you got to get on message. You've got to make sure that you're really reaching these people in the flyover states and not just concentrate on the two coasts?
Yeah, there's a guy that's sometimes referred to as the big dog. Bill Clinton was absolutely arguing for her to go out and talk to people that didn't agree with her and for the campaign to let him do that. They thought mm-hmm. A lot of folks in the Brooklyn headquarters thought it was a waste of time for him to try to persuade people to vote for his wife and instead wanted him in cities and in places where they thought that he could help boost the turnout of people who already agreed with her. This was one of the fundamental disagreements in the campaign over the course of months and months and months. And ultimately, Hillary went with her younger generation of folks who are very reliant on data analytics and trying to slice and dice the electorate. And some people posited to us that they thought that was in part due to her loss in 2008 to Barack Obama, where
right.
she got so much credit for being technologically advanced. And, you know, instead of her looking at it and saying, well, maybe I got to figure out how to be better at persuading people. She thought, well, he beat me because his technology was better. And she kind of stuck with that.
So, again, you know, I guess she overcorrected, you would say.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I think that she tried to kind of, she had 8 years to sort of build another campaign and do it better this time. And in some ways, yes, that was a conclusion that we made, that she kind of swung in the other direction too far.
While you were writing this book, Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign, by the way, folks, we're talking with Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes, the authors of that book. Was there anything that really stuck out in your mind? Anything that surprised you?
That's a great question. I think, you know, one of the things that surprised us was sort of the level of dysfunction and the level of sort of warring that went on behind the scenes in the campaign, because publicly there was very little of that that leaked out. And so we were a little surprised. I mean, it's hard to say surprised now because we became aware of it pretty early on in the process. But I think that the frustrations that the certain staff members had with each other and with their inability to find this message for her, you know, were pretty amazing. And in particular, we report for the first time in this book some of the changes she made to her staff without ever announcing them publicly. She really wanted people to think she was running this steady, stable campaign, but she basically, you know, moved her chief strategist off to the side and elevated this guy, Jake Sullivan, who'd been with her at the State Department, to chief strategist. She thought that there was too much of a problem, the clashing between the campaign chairman, John Podesta, and the campaign manager, Robbie Mook. Instead of giving one of them power, she actually created a sort of board of directors within the campaign called the Super Six, and they basically had six people running the campaign, if you can imagine that.
Wow. Yeah, just too many cooks spoil the broth, I think they say. Huma Abedin, what kind of a role did she play in this campaign, and where does she get to take part in any of the fault?
I think a lot of people post-campaign have blamed her for being too much of a gatekeeper, for not relaying information to Secretary Clinton, for, you know, people would come to her with problems and she would say that she was going to alert Secretary Clinton and never did.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, with this reopening of the FBI investigation, the one that was announced a couple weeks before the campaign ended, she went to a couple of other senior advisors and asked what the best thing for her to do would be, and they told her essentially to go home for a few days and not be seen on the campaign trail, and that was a really interesting moment that we reveal in the book because of the role that that she's played throughout Secretary Clinton's career and the closeness she has to her, but they just didn't want those pictures out there.
Well, of course, because of, I guess, her husband, Anthony Weiner. I mean, that was also a big scandal.
Right.
They couldn't have helped.
Yeah, exactly. And it came, the scandal happened a couple weeks out before the election was wrapping up, and so they really didn't want that image of Huma out there with Secretary Clinton.
So was there a key point? Was there a key in writing this book? Do you think there was a key moment in time where this campaign became doomed, as you say?
You know, it's interesting with the sort of the question of the Titanic hitting the iceberg. You know, it's been on course for a long time and you don't see the iceberg till the last minute. So I don't know if it's one point. I think it's a lot of points. In fact, I would say that our conclusion more than anything is there was a sort of perfect storm that led to the election of Donald Trump. And there are any number of factors that you could change and see, you know, 78,000 votes in the right states flipping hands. So,
right.
It's hard to say exactly what that moment was or what that thing was. I think you look at the series of factors and try to figure out which are the biggest ones. And we think that the biggest ones were self-contained, or basically ones that point to Hillary Clinton, either, you know, basically her decision-making. And that's not a value judgment about her, you know, her priorities or her politics or whatever, just simply analyzing the decisions she made over the course of several years and looking at them and saying these are things that, you know, she really hurt herself on.
Right. Using the Titanic analogy, you know, there wasn't a huge gash in the hull, but there were 1,000 tiny cracks that caused the ship to sink. But ultimately, like you said, the responsibility lies with Hillary, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's true. Yeah.
All right. So, well, you guys are fascinating. It's a fascinating book, fascinating read. Jonathan Allen, Amy Parnes, thank you so much for being on the program today, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.